Okay. Hi, welcome everyone. Today is April 13th. This is the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. And we are going to start with a work session on House Bill 2239 so that Representative Davis can present the amendment. Would you like to read the bill?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2239, you may recall, we heard on March the 20th. It creates a tax credit for businesses that hire at-risk or disadvantaged youth, allows certified businesses a 25% credit for wages paid to qualifying youth, directs the Oregon Department of Revenue to define at-risk or disadvantaged youth, directs DOR to adopt rules directing policy and procedures to certify credit eligibility, applies to tax years beginning January 1st, 2015 through January 1st, 2021, takes effect 91st day after signee die. There is a dash for amendment pending, which defines at-risk youth and adds parameters for tax credit eligibility, adds youth with intellectual and developmental disability to eligible employees, adds definition of youth with intellectual and developmental disability, and removes the rulemaking process for certification.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer, member of the committee. I'm State Representative John Davis, here to discuss the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2239. After some great discussions with stakeholders, the Department of Revenue, Department of Education, we came up with the Dash 4 amendments, which do a couple of things. Primarily, they add some more definition to at-risk or disadvantaged youth. The bill previously requested that the Department of Revenue make this definition in rulemaking, which a number of us thought was unnecessary considering the fact that we already have definitions in many places in statute, and the Department of Education already has the definition in rule. So you'll see in the Dash 4 amendments, at-risk or disadvantaged youth would now be defined without any need to go to Department of Revenue as students who are eligible for free or reduced price lunch, individuals taking part in an IEP, children who are not enrolled in school, children who are currently placed in foster care, children who are youth offenders, and children who are in the custody of the Oregon Youth Authority. This does a couple of things. First of all, it eliminates the requirement for Department of Revenue's rulemaking. It also gives us some more hard data on how much this tax credit might actually cost, because we can pull some good data on this. Finally, this amendment also adds two sidebars, one of which, at the suggestion of the chair, which I thought was excellent, requires the student to have worked at least 200 hours during the year. So basically a summer job, for example, would qualify, but not some student who's just working an hour or two a week. And it would also make clear, this is the intent originally in the bill, but it just makes clear that when you take the credit for the 25% of the wage paid to at-risk or disadvantaged youth, that is taken instead of and not in addition to the existing business deduction, from income for wages that we currently have. So that's what the Dash 4 does, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Representative Davis, do you know what the fiscal is on this yet, or is that something Chris?
Madam Chair, I emailed Chris a little earlier today. I don't think it's ready yet. No.
Okay, great. Any questions, Representative Davis? I know he is vice chair of transportation and needs to get back over there.
Thank you very much.
A lot
much.
Of work session.
Oh, that one.
Sorry, Representative Hayden.
Great bill. Good idea. Thank you.
Oh. That's a good thing to hear.
Thank you.
Very much. All right. Okay, I'm going to close the work session on that particular one. We are going to roll that one over to the Wednesday agenda. And we will be rolling over House Bill 2116, which is the really big tax credit for child and dependent care, because we don't have the numbers ready for that. We don't have the fiscal ready for that. But I am going to open up the, I don't know whether to open a work session or just talk about it.
Madam Chair, you can go ahead and open a work session.
I'm going to open a work session on all of the tax credits for the purpose of going through the documents that are now on OLIS and that you received earlier today. So that's House Bill 2068, House Bill 2113, House Bill 2116, 2119, 2122, 2130.
Not 2130.
And that's it. So I will open those up and walk you through, and we will see which are ready to move and which should be rolled over. Get a temperature gauge here. So thank you to Chris Alanuck for providing us color copies. So you've got this in front of you, which everyone else hopefully can see on OLIS at this point. There's four different documents that I want to kind of walk you through, and you've heard a lot about these before. The two primary ones that go over all of the tax, or at least mention all the tax credits, are an Excel sheet in color and then a text sheet, which is tax recommendations. So let me start with the Excel sheet because it's a very simple way of laying out how we're going to, how we're looking at these tax credits. Does everyone see that one? This color, this, mm-hmm. not that graph, but this one.
Yeah.
So it says tax credit renewals at the top, and these are in millions of dollars, and they're for the biennium, and they all sunset in 6 years for this first group. So the first one is 2113, Office of Child Care Quality Incentives. Our House bill is amended to increase the amount to $5 million, which is what the amount was for the Senate side. Senate bill 212. We did not have as much discussion on this particular one because that was kind of the one piece that the Senate dug into a little bit more than we did. They had more testimony on it, and in addition to the amount, it actually had some policy recommendations as well. All of the other credits that we're considering were pretty much just submitted by the Senate to the Joint Tax Credit Committee as continue. At the same amount. They didn't really pay a lot of attention because they knew that we were, and I've kind of kept them up to date with what we're doing. So this is the only one that we're kind of following their lead on that. And my recommendation was to pass that one. And I'm happy to take any questions as we go, but I wanted to just give you the big sense of where we're going. The second one was House Bill 2115, which is the Working Family Child Care Tax Credit. It cost $43.5 million if at the current cost of current biennium. And that is the one that I am have been suggesting and working with a group of people to sunset and fold it into the CDC, into the state CDC. And if you, I'm not sure why the bottom didn't print, but hopefully it's on OLIS. It talks about the 1,600 and I think 49 people that had received working family that did not receive the CDC, and looking into them by category to see if there's anyone that we're kind of categorically eliminating that we don't intend to. And it did not appear, especially because that the people who are left out every year are not the same people. There's no kind of systematic leaving people out that we're aware of. The one exception could be part-time students because that's not designated on the tax return. So the child and dependent care is the one that we're looking at. If you look at $16.7 million now, we're looking at stepping up dramatically. So the $64 million would include the working family and the child and dependent care together, and because of what we intend to do with that, and that is now on this page, adding those two together and trying to even out the stepping up the credit, making it refundable, which helps people at lower income since they don't have a tax liability. The tax credit doesn't help them. So it's making it a lot more like an EITC, both in its shape. So it gradually goes up, plateaus somewhat, and then gradually goes down. And you can see the red on the back is the proposed credit. And so it's kind of substantially shifted it to lower income. Evens it out a little bit at the top. And if you look at the color again, if you want to look at the blues, those are the federal CDC and then the two Oregon credits together, you can compare for the 0 to 2-year-olds, the 3 to 5-year-olds, and the elementary school, and 13 to 17 if disabled, the different credit amounts. So that's the one that that we've put the most work into. So let me keep going. The child with disability and an adult with a severe disability are the next two categories. Those are personal exemptions. And the suggestion is to continue those. They are indexed so that personal exemption goes up a little bit every year, but to cap it at $100,000 per household, which would be $1.4 million savings in the child with a disability and a $1 million savings over a biennium for people with severe disabilities. And this chart right here shows you, if you cut it off at $100,000, where that savings would be. So that goes into those two. The next four are tax credits that that I suggest we sunset. And in the case of loss of limbs and elderly and permanently disabled, these are ones that are used by very few people. The long-term care insurance premium is the biggest one, but it's used by mostly upper-income people. The majority of people are ones that make over $100,000, and it's not a product that is actively sold or is seen as very useful anymore. And then the cost in lieu of nursing home care also was hardly used at all, and the amount of it was so small. It was a few hundred dollars a year that the idea behind it was to help keep people at home, but really, with a few hundred dollars a year, it could not make the difference for most families in being able to keep somebody at home versus putting them in institutional care. And so we, part of the CDC, again, if you go back to the CDC, this one, sorry that people who are on audio may not hear it, but the one with the graphs on the back, you'll see that the category of CDC, people who used to get the CDC, adults who are incapacitated, people who are taking care of adults who are incapacitated, actually gets the most bump up, but they don't get as much as other people. But when you think that they didn't used to get the working family tax credit, but they only got the CDC, they had the most room to gain. And because we're closing off two other tax credits, one being the long-term care premium insurance, and the long-term care insurance premium, and the other being the in lieu of nursing, it seems fair to bump this up a little bit more dramatically. So those are the renewals. And before I go any further, why don't I stop and see if you have any questions about those? Yeah.
Thank you, Chair Kinniger. The loss of limbs.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the presentation, and I know it wasn't for very many, and I know it's hardly used. The part that I didn't really know is, well, are those people going to be really impacted? And it seems, I guess I'm just a little worried about it.
So there's a lot of little credits out there that don't really do much, so the idea was to try to streamline them. That particular credit went out to about $25,000 a year, went out in $25,000 a year or biennium, I'm forgetting now. It was about 500 people that got $50 each, and they have to have lost two limbs. And those are the same population that would qualify for people with a severe disability, because severe disability is loss of any limb, even one limb, or blindness, or other things. And that personal exemption is, I think, $192 now.
Follow-up. So yep. For clarification, would they get the $50 in addition to the $190?
Yes. So they will be losing $50.
So, I mean, you lost two limbs. It seems like
that is probably why you're on this committee.
Well, I mean, my gosh, it seems like, I don't know.
You know, there's an administrative cost to doing all of these things, and it just was not anything that anyone came and testified in favor of, I think.
Who knows? How did I get here?
I don't know. Is it necessary to, if I appreciate that there's administrative costs. I do appreciate that. I guess I just wonder if it's necessary to get rid of.
So here's the reality. I haven't heard the concern before. The bill is dead because it had to have a work session scheduled. So there may be other ways to get at that population, but in terms of that particular, well, it's not really dead. It came through on the Senate side. So
isn't it on a work session now?
You said $50 was the
$50. Times 500 people.
I just don't think $50 is going to really impact behavior in any meaningful way for anyone. And the administrative costs, I bet, take a majority of that, or if not a significant portion of it. So.
Yes, Representative King.
Thank you, Chair Kinnegar. Correct me if I'm incorrect here, but I think we're talking about 2119? The
loss
severe
of,
disability?
No, 2120, loss of limbs. 2120 is the loss of limbs.
The 2119
is the suggestion is to continue with that, and 2120 was tied off in our committee. It cannot go forward in our committee. I believe everything was sent through on the Senate side.
So one alternative suggestion, which I think we talked about in the public hearing, was to actually, the reason it was only $50 is that it was put in place back in the 70s or early 80s. And it was never indexed. So one suggestion was to actually index that and bring it up to something that would be equitable for the people that utilize that. So just wanted to say that.
But now they also have the severe disability tax credit that they'd qualify for if they had lost
that indexed. That is indexed. And, you know, the point is, like, should someone with two limbs get additional, in addition to the severe disability, as opposed to somebody who's blind or someone who has another, you know, one particular disability is called out and gets something else.
But like the working families in the CDC, where we're rolling those together, mm-hmm. we're not doing that in this case. Mm-hmm. We're actually eliminating one.
Yeah, if I was rolling it
forward.
Together, I was.
Anyway.
It just seems awfully.
It just seems like even though it's a small amount of money.
If you're the person sitting there with two lost limbs, you're
sometimes we stand up for the little guy, I guess.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to see if I'm understanding properly. On 2120 and 2121, those were not scheduled for a work session, and therefore those are dead.
Those bills will not be extended. Right. There are Senate versions that I believe all went on to the Tax Credit Committee.
Okay.
So if people wanted to, you know, lobby for those. You could certainly do so.
So what's, we're just giving our recommendations then? Or?
So the bills that are going forward are the ones that that are on our agenda for today. It's four of them have been sunsetted as far as our committee is going. And these are ones that I've kind of brought up repeatedly
You didn't do anything.
So from a process perspective, because there is no bill, then the administrative decision of the legislature is those just sunset out of this committee.
Out of this committee, they sunset.
Because, so we didn't even bring it forward, the bill forward to revenue to have that subsequent debate. We just.
Right, correct.
A decision was made that.
Yes, my recommendation based on previous conversations I've had here, here's my intention. I'm not bringing them back. I plan to sunset them unless anyone really advocates for them. No one did. And so as far as this committee is concerned, those bills are dead.
So the follow-up question is, then what happens in the revenue committee as they look at these? Were these bills the mechanism to continue the conversation, or just one person as the chair made a decision that four tax credits go away?
Well, I think, you know,
Vote of the body.
Yeah. I have tried to put it on the table that these are that unless anyone really wants to have these considered for a vote, I'm not working them. That happens with a lot of bills.
Well,
I'm not working these.
It might happen with a lot of bills, but we're talking about existing credits that are available to people without a vote of the body. They just sunsetted without a debate on the floor. I mean, like, the process behind that, and I'm glad that there's a Senate bill that continues them, but in absentia, one person as the chair, no, you know, no, you know, just if this is where we're going to go with the every 6 year sunset and we just start sunsetting things without a vote, I think that's a really bigger problem than just whether or not we're going to give somebody $50, you know, about that one particular topic. Mm-hmm. This sets a really dangerous precedent in my mind mm-hmm. to suddenly start expiring tax deductions or and credits that consumers get or voters get without a full vote of the body. I mean, I think that that's a practice problem if we're going to every 6 years start having these conversations about what sunsets and what doesn't, and we just let things die.
Okay, so just to keep the conversation, my apologies as a new chair. I felt like I had checked in a lot with people. There are bills that don't come for a vote by the whole committee because there was not the support to go forward, or chair's prerogative. But in this particular case, I felt like I had checked in. I'm happy to check in with people about these bills and give a different kind of recommendation to say that there was split feeling about some of these bills when we make the recommendation to the tax credit committee. But for the purpose of the House bills, they are dead.
Mm-hmm. So, Chair Kinninger.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say I support the chair's interpretation. I mean, I felt like there was an invitation to participate in discussions about these several times.
Chair,
and I certainly have.
I was just going to interject, Madam Chair, members of the committee, regarding the process, and I know that Chris can speak to the process as well. Is for each bill that that is on the bill list, a memo will be sent to the Joint Tax Committee, and that memo can reflect mm-hmm. a variety of things, including the committee's decision to allow a tax credit to sunset. And so that has been just wanting to lay that out there as a portion of the process.
And the other reality is every time you put a bill on for a work session, there's an enormous amount of work that goes into the fiscal and the summary. And we have 31 bills in the next five sessions. And so, yeah.
Chair Kinninger, thank you. First of all, I do support you, and I understand now. I think, and I'm going to admit, because I'm new, that what I misunderstood, and now I'll know going forward, then I should have, you know, spoken up more about that. I didn't quite realize how this works, and so I just want to take responsibility for that, and I do support what you're doing, and I understand. You also know me well enough to know that when I see something like, you know, $50 for someone who lost two limbs, I think, my God, this seems like the least we could do. So I should have spoken up more, and I understand that. So but it seems that at the time then, what I'll know going forward is that when we have these sunsets, that's when you need to advocate if you want to keep it. So thank you.
And so I'm going to follow up because I was under the assumption, and so maybe it's my own fault for not checking in, but I was under the assumption we were going to make a recommendation on all of those things and then send it on down to the Revenue Committee and the tax credit or whoever they were going to, but send it on down to them to then have the subsequent look. But and maybe somebody who's been here longer than me can correct me if I'm wrong, but I've not, since I've been here, seen a tax credit just expire for lack of coming forward. And then at the committee level without a vote. So I don't, somebody else who's been in this building longer than me, you maybe correct me.
Chris, do you want to come up?
An existing program, not a new program, but an existing program just expire and not, because that's a significant shift.
So I will tell you that the direction that I had from the Joint Tax Credit Committee is please pare this down and don't send us so many. It's very hard for them to handle all those, and it's a lot of work for the committee staff to have to come up with a lot of the administrative and the fiscal and the summaries when there's no policy recommendation from the policy committee to continue those.
Okay,
so I felt like that was pretty clear direction. Yeah.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. I'm trying to rifle through my memory. There have been some tax expenditures. Sometimes there have been a couple of property tax items, perhaps a couple of credits that didn't even get a bill drafted in the session. And so they automatically sunset. And then proponents found out that they sunset after the fact, and then they would lobby to bring them back. there have been some tax credits, and I would have to confirm and go through all of my notes over the past couple of sessions. The formal process that the legislature is going in is kind of a work in progress and has been moderate. You know, with 2009 is when in House Bill 2067, all or virtually all of the tax credits had a sunset put on them. And then in 2011 and 2013 were the first of the three groups to go through this process. And I would to get a precise answer to your question, I would want to go through my notes about which credits made it from the policy committee down to JTAX. Because in 2011 was the first time we had the bills, and they were just straight sunset extension bills sent to the policy committees, and then the policy committees decided what to do and then sent them on down to JTAX. I would have to confirm exactly what happened in some of those policy committees. Not all of the tax credits have been continued in the two sessions. In each of the sessions, maybe three, four, five tax credits were allowed to sunset. One tax credit, the sunset was actually moved forward to end that revenue was used for a direct spending program. So the action that the legislature as a whole has taken since 2009 has been a variety of actions, everything from moving it up to use the revenue somewhere else to extending and modifying tax programs. In terms of where all of that work occurred, whether it was in the policy committees or JTAX, it's been different in 2011 and 2013.
Follow up. So I guess what my level of concern is that I have not, when we've had some of those discussions, and this is the first policy committee I've been on that effectively has said we're not going to send these down to revenue or whatever. In fact, I don't know that I've been on any policy committee that has taken this process. And then to make it have a no up or down vote on whether or not to extend any of them, I've not seen that happen. So that's what I'm trying to wrap my head around, because that seems like it is a deviation from what I've seen in this is the fifth, full session that I've been here. I've not seen us actually do that before. And I'm sort of wondering, what the implication on the other end is if something sunsets, we haven't voted up or down. I mean, effectively, the guy with the two lost limbs is going to get a tax increase without a vote of the people. So that was in law. And we can have that discussion whether we should do it. But effectively, what we've done by not having it up or down one way or the other is raised his taxes without his knowledge. Yes? No? I mean, that's what's going to happen on April 15th when
yes.
He pays his taxes.
In under current law, all of this group of tax credits under current law, they are all gone at the end of this year. 2015 will be the last year that they can claim that. So on that particular tax credit, they'll be able to claim it next year at this time for tax year 2015, but the following year they wouldn't be able to claim it, and that's under current law.
So, and I would just say that this is the first time I've seen any tax credits, because none came through my committee since I'm on Health and Human Services. All of the Health and Human Service tax credits are up since a third happen every 2 years to get through that six-year cycle. This is the first year I've seen any, so I don't have any history to go on, but I've made my intention very clear on this committee with the chair of the tax joint tax credit, the chair of revenue, and the speaker's office, and Chris, and the advocates that I've been meeting with, that as a policy committee, if we don't think this is a good policy anymore, we will let the bills die. And the chair of the joint tax committee and the revenue has said, please do that so we're not flooded. So that are the operations, that the assumptions that I've been operating. I can see that there could be an argument for bringing it up for a work session and deciding to vote it down, or making a recommendation. We're passing with no recommendation, pass with no recommendation. I could see how that might be a suggested way forward. I had never considered that, because I thought I was following directions. Mm-hmm. And I do think that that adds an enormous amount of work for committee staff. So I will check later procedurally with, what I should have done. But I have said it at repeated meetings here on the record. Here's my intention with these. So if anyone wants to argue for them, please come forward. So.
Final comment? Well, my final comment to you is, when I hear somebody say, if anyone wants to argue for them, my assumption is, okay, well, that's when we have an up or down vote. I'm going to make my argument, not behind closed doors and not have that conversation.
No, not behind closed doors.
Well,
I was inviting
it
out here.
Even in this format, you know, to say whether or not we should have a work session on those. This has not been historically what I've seen happen, is that we have that debate right here about are we going to work these bills or not work these bills. That usually in most committees.
No, in most committees, there's a lot of things that never come to a work session. They die before you get to
sort of outside of that. But these feel different to me, though, because effectively, whether we get a chance to up or down vote on any of these and make that recommendation, I probably would have voted no had the bill been here on the $50, because I see that as a tax increase for that person. But taking away that up or down vote really takes it outside of the public purview. And there are going to be people who are going to look at that and say, what just happened to my tax credit? So I feel like those should have all been moved forward, up or down as a vote. And I did not realize, so my own mistake in not realizing that we should have said bring them all so we can have the up or down vote. But that, I feel like that should have happened, because now, in effect, you have a direction that you'd like to go, and taking that off of not having a chance to vote on that means effectively we all by consent and by not stepping up and saying, you know, we want to have those votes up or down, effectively we've all just said we agree with the policy. And I feel like that wasn't where I wanted to head.
Okay, so I'm going to end the conversation here. I think we've talked a lot about it. We by having had the discussion several times, I thought that the committee was with me. Please, I'll make the plea right now. If I raise issues, and I invite you to say it transparently in the public, but even if you don't do that, come see me at some other point and let me know, wait, you know, I don't like the direction that you're taking this, because I've made a real point of saying it on the record several times. So let's go ahead. We have the next. Does anyone want to ask anything else about the renewals? Okay, then the next part is the new proposals. You've already heard about the employer credit hiring at-risk youth from Representative Davis. And we don't have the fiscal on that, so we will bring that back for discussion on Wednesday. You have them by Wednesday, the fiscal.
Madam Chair, I'm continuing to work on getting the data to. I have a structure to come up with the estimates.
Okay.
So it's a matter of getting some data. Okay. And you do. The committee does have a light statement on the bill. So, unable to move the bill, you have a statement to move it.
What is that,
Madam Chair? We do have a fiscal and revenue light, meaning that there's further analysis needed. So, at this point, the committee does have the necessary paperwork to move the bills to JTAX. Where the fiscal analysis, the revenue analysis and the fiscal analysis will continue to happen. So in terms of process for this committee, the paperwork's there. We don't have a full picture of what the full revenue is. There is, however, on OLIS, let me find it very briefly.
I didn't see anything.
There are two statements, and there's a revenue impact and a fiscal impact that sort of summarize the bill, but it doesn't have a dollar figure. So at this point, it's
okay. But you think you'll have a dollar figure by Wednesday?
I don't know. It's another one of the things I'm actively working on.
Okay.
It's to get some initial data on, now that we have the dash fours are out, so now that specifically identifies the groups of qualifying youths. And okay. So if I can get, I'm trying to get numbers for each of those groups.
Pardon me, Madam Chair. My apologies. 2239 will move to the Revenue Committee and not to the Tax Committee.
Because it's new. It's a new credit. Okay, and then the EITC. You can see a graph here of what it would cost if you increase the EITC credit. And the recommendation in the bill, as amended, would be to increase it to 14%, which would be $7 million a year. That would be $7 million in this biennium, because it would only be the second year. But it would mean $14 million in future biennium.
Yeah, and there, the revenue impact statement, I do have numbers for that in the revenue impact statement that's in OLIS.
Does it say anything beyond that?
That's effectively what it is.
Okay. And the idea behind that was that there may be people who don't want to put their kid in childcare in the very first year, or maybe they have several kids in childcare, and so it costs a lot when you add all that up, even with tax credits, transportation. And so this allows lower-income families to have some of their loss of income when they stay home with their child to have that offset by the credit. One of the recommendations that came out of the Duncan study, that one of the best things that we can do to help lift low-income families out of poverty, and, well, particularly to help give a boost to very young children in low-income families, would be to double the tax credit. That would actually be 16%. And we would be the first state to make that differentiation if we go forward with that policy. So, okay. Any other discussion on any of these by the committee? I think also because, yes, Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Kenny-Geyer. I have one amendment that I would like to get introduced. Maybe I can get this done in a day or two, to 2119, that would include a $210 tax credit for severe disabilities with two limbs. Would I have the option to?
I think, so in light of this discussion, I'm going to hold over all of, I'm not going to try to work any of these bills today. I think we can just put them back on the agenda really briefly for Wednesday. Can we do that?
I believe so. I'm going to double
and
check.
I would really appreciate hearing from people, like, soon in the next few hours,
okay,
how you're feeling about any of these, whether they're ones that you would pass, if you want them amended, because we have to move really quickly.
Okay.
Can I also?
Yeah.
I'd also like to say, you know, I mean, one of the things I think that we need to think about is that, that helping people is not always a matter of throwing money at the problem. And I think that, I'd like to hear just how effective is $50 or $250 if somebody loses a limb. I mean, I just don't think that's really very much money. I don't think it's very effective in terms of any kind of assistance. So I'd like to hear some feedback on that if your amendment is entertained.
Okay. I think the other thing for me is pulling out one particular disability, like why that one. You have severe disability, which covers that population and a lot of others. And so, you know, who are we as a state or a policy committee to say, and in addition, we want to pull out people who've lost both limbs and add this. I mean, there's not a compelling policy argument in my view for that. But if you can...
Can I respond?
Yes, please.
I think if you did consolidate it like we're doing with the other ones, that you lower the administrative burden, and these people have had this for, since I believe in testimony, 1976, 79, something like that.
The loss of limbs?
Yeah.
Mid-70s-ish.
Yeah. So if you do combine it, they've had it hysterically for, you know, 40 years. Yeah, it probably doesn't change their life, but makes a nice teddy bear for their kid, mm-hmm. you know, something like that. So, anyway.
Okay. I'd appreciate hearing from people on the committee where they are in that. So I think it's also fair at this point to open it up if there are any comments from people, because ideas keep emerging, particularly the Representative Davis's. We had one set of testimony, but his amendment further refines that. So, yeah.
Madam Chair?
Yeah.
Can I
Okay, so we're going to stand at ease for a minute. Okay, welcome back to the Human Services and Housing Committee. We're going to resume the work session on bills 2068, 2113, 2116, 2119, 2122, and 2239 for the purpose of, I think we had that one open. For the purpose of hearing from anyone else, my intention is to roll all of these over to Wednesday, check in with my committee.
Carry over.
Hopefully these will go really quickly, but if there's anyone that would like to comment on any of these, so that we have things to think about as we read over the next 2 days. Is there anyone that wants to take this opportunity? Yeah.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center, but this is more akin to the work that I do with the Human Services Coalition of Oregon Tax and Revenue Committee. The one thing that I would just, there are actually two things I want to say. First of all, I appreciate the fact that the chair had an inclusive group to talk about a whole bunch of these things in depth. And the second thing that I would say is that we've been following very closely, of course, the directions that have come from the co-chairs, and not only about what happens in Ways and Means, but what the directions are to the Joint Tax Committee, where they have to deal with all of the expiring tax credits, $64 million, with $14 million that have been allocated not only for expiring tax credits, but anything new, like the discussion you've had on Representative Davis's tax credit would be a new tax credit. So I just say that I recognize discussions like this are really very difficult, and I think, as the chair mentioned about the issue about the tax credit for the LIMS, that this came about back in the 70s, and as Chris has done his detective work on looking at tax credits, they've all happened in different eras, and the reasoning for them is really in many instances non-existent. So I just want to commend the discussion on all sides about having a discussion about things that are really important, but I also wanted to put that budget context out there for consideration. And then finally, I just also want to underscore something that the chair said about the work that the Senate committees have been doing, because I've been, as often as I can, I've gotten to all of the various committees, and in many instances, the committee simply passed everything down to the Joint Tax Credit Committee, in spite of the fact that there were directions to do what the chair has mentioned, to try to get a better sense about what's really important to the policy committees. Human Services Coalition was a part of the discussion that led up to this process, so we always had high hopes that the policy committees would dig into these expiring tax credits and make recommendations. But again, this is really a very hard discussion, and to put any kind of rationale on tax credits that have passed a number of years ago and putting them into modern context is difficult. So I just wanted to put that on the record and thank everybody for the discussion.
Thank you. Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair. I just have a question on process here. Mm-hmm. As we're looking at 2115, working family child care, and 2116, child dependent care, as we talk about folding one into the other. And this is, maybe someone can clarify the process once it leaves this committee for me. But one of my just overarching concerns is if we tie off working families with the, so it stops here, with the assumption that it would go into the CDC, how do we know that it would actually go into the CDC later? I'm worried that we would tie it, and then if it didn't go in, then I wouldn't have ever tied it.
Right.
How do we know that?
The Senate, you know, they will have two sets of bills that come to them. They'll have the Senate, which is just continue as we've been doing, and then they'll have the House version, which is restructuring it. My intention is to make, you know, to talk to the Tax Credit Committee, go on record, talk to them about this set of recommendations, and talk about the reasons for including those two. I think that one of the things that I tried to do with the numbers here is make sure that we did not, that we, if anything, cut back in the amount of credits, just barely. But I recognize that there's also been, out of the 64, they say 64 million, it's actually more than 64 million in continuing tax credits, but out of that, they said don't continue any more than 14 million. And obviously that's the part, the financial part, that they have to wrestle with. How much are they going to allocate to tax credits? Because they may end up cutting down pieces. They could have done that anyway with the working family. They could have said, we're going to cut everything by a half. And then, in fact, our half would still pretty much be the same because it's two vehicles, two tax credits, that pretty much went to the same population. So whether we combine it or not, if they decide to slash everything by half, then they should probably come out about the same. But ours is also not just the amount, it's how we structure it. So the refundable parts and all of that. So I've pretty much had very good reception on that side, that if they said, if you're really trying to prioritize getting more money to low-income families, making it refundable, raising the caps, shifting a little bit of more of the priority toward, in child care arena, toward the infant and toddler care, which is way more expensive, you know, I think that they're going to take a lot of that framework. They may cut some of it back. And I don't know how they'll do that, if it's percentage-wise or if they'll just decide we want to cut, you know, a whole credit itself. I somehow don't think they'll do that. If something came out of the policy committee saying this is a population that we think should continue to be served by this tax credit, my guess is that they would pare it back if they felt like they needed to, as opposed to just cut something. Yes, Representative Parrish.
So the 2115 particularly gives me heartburn, and I, you know, we're not going to hear that bill, because that's now administratively being tied off. And I've been very clear on the record that I have real concerns about changing the income. And I look at your chart, and I appreciate it. Make my eyes hurt because it's tight small. I don't realize I needed glasses now. But when I look at that, you know, sort of what I would consider truly your middle-class families, $60,000 type families, and they're effectively getting a cut, I think we missed the boat in not getting a chance to get that on the record, that there are some of us have a problem with that, and just I wouldn't have voted on 2115. I would have voted it no. I appreciate what you're trying to do in making those transitions and changes, but I think giving a family making $60,000 a year a hit on their daycare could cause a real, and I've said it several times, could cause a very real shift in their, you know, decision-making process about who works in their family and who doesn't and how they have to structure their work life to make that happen. And that's the piece I think I'm just very frustrated about, because while I might not have gotten on the record about loss of limbs, and maybe that we do need to have a conversation about that, I've been very clear about my concern on the piece. And effectively, we just are making a policy decision without a vote, saying that we're all okay with giving families in the mid-income range a haircut on daycare. And I'm wanting to get that on the record, that I am not okay with that. And I think that if we aren't able to pass that on into a bill to the next committee, they don't get to hear that debate. Nobody from joint tax credits is going to sit here and listen to this as they go forward. They're just going to say that we didn't make that happen, you know, and we didn't send it down to them. So therefore, as a policy decision, we're all okay with that. And I'm going to just keep saying on the record, I'm not okay with that. I'm not okay that so that particular one didn't get a vote.
That's great. That's one of the kind. I mean, I think that's a really important policy consideration. I was looking at the cutoff at 300%. Representative Bueller and I have been working on this a little bit together. We thought that seemed like it was honoring the making sure that families, especially if they got off of ERDC, at 250%. But I would love to hear that kind of feedback and love to know where people are. I mean, we can make that kind of change between now and Wednesday if that's a feeling that people here share. So please go over all of these. Look at, you know, so what you're saying is let's go from the 300% down to the 130% at least, because that's the category that had the CDC before that is not included in this. So from 300 to 330%. And you might even say it should go to 350%. But in any case, please give me your reactions, because we need to get amendments by Wednesday in order to vote. And I'd like to get the temperature of where people are feeling on this committee. Okay. I think that's it. No other comments. So I'm going to close the work session on 2068, 2113, 2116, 2119, 2122, and 2239. And open a work session on 2130. Robin, could you read the bill?
Certainly. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2130 allows governing bodies to establish reasonable maximum holding times for land designated for low-income housing development for the purposes of property tax exemption, allows governing bodies to elect additional criteria to extend exemption, takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment, sine die. There is a -1 amendment pending. It makes the language consistent in the statute, and
the paperwork is in order for both no revenue impact, no fiscal impact.
Great. I am hoping, John Van Lanningham, could you come up to clarify something that came up in response to Representative Hayden's question about clawbacks last time around?
Gwen is also here, too.
And Gwen, would you like to come up at the same time? If you'd like to make any final comments or answer any questions from the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. John Van Lanningham. I'm a legal aid lawyer from Eugene, and I testified in favor of this bill at your public hearing. I think this will encourage more local governments to choose to adopt this property tax exemption, which will help affordable housing projects. So I'm supporting Beaverton's request. Representative Hayden asked a number of questions, some of which I got right, one of which I got wrong, and that was about whether there was in the existing statute. You'll recall that this bill amends two different property tax exemptions, so two sets of statutes. They're comparable but different. Representative Hayden's question was, do they have clawbacks? In other words, if somebody violates the conditions and the property tax exemption is withdrawn by the adopting local government, is there a way to recapture that property tax? We exempted property tax. And I said, well, no, that the current statutes don't do that. I was wrong. They already do that. So if someone who's received an exemption from the local government under these two programs violates the criteria, statutes already provide for revoking the exemption and for making them pay taxes going forward and backwards, claw back for 10 years.
Thank you for the clarification. Gwen, would you like to add anything?
Just, I really appreciate
Chair Guy. You have to say your name for
Gwen Baldwin, City of Beaverton. Chair Guy, members of the committee, we really appreciate your enthusiasm for looking at the tools that local governments can opt into to help provide and address affordable housing, and very much appreciate the questions and the consideration of really digging into something that we think is going to be a real improvement.
Great. Who's got the Representative Stark? Okay. Representative Stark, can I have a motion?
Chair Kenny Guerra, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 1/29/15.
Yeah, it's Dash 1. Vice Chair Stark moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 1/29/15. Is there any discussion? Yes.
I was going to try and ask a question. With the clawbacks, with that being determined, does that not then, in fact, give more leverage than what the bill originally asked for?
Would you like to come back and answer that? I think clawbacks are permissive, not mandatory, right?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, John Van Lanningham from Lane County Legal Aid. So the bill doesn't amend the existing clawback provisions. The bill doesn't amend the statutes where the clawbacks are. So the bill wouldn't change the existing statutes that provide for the clawback, and it's a 10-year back period for if you're not complying with the criteria and haven't been for some period of time, the clawback would cover all those up to 10 years. Is that what you were asking? Did I miss the question? Okay.
Yeah. What I was asking was when this was presented to us, it wasn't aware that the clawback was in statute already. It appears to me, having read that, and thank you for bringing that information, it appears to me that the clawback, knowing that it's there, gives the county more leverage than they realized they had, and actually more leverage than what they were asking for in this bill separately. Is that not correct?
So, Chair Kenny Guyer and Representative Hayden, I don't believe that the city views it that way, although perhaps Gwen Baldwin ought to answer it that. What the bill does is to allow the local government to have more criteria up front. So you're right in the sense that there would be more ways in which a recipient of the exemption could fail to comply with the criteria. And so there will be more incentive for a recipient of the exemption to comply with the criteria, knowing that the clawback is there. The clawback has been there since the beginning. Mm-hmm. What this bill will be to add more criteria, or allow a local government to have more criteria, and the clawback would be a tool that the city could use to enforce those criteria. So you're right in that sense.
Follow up?
Yep.
So So then, in effect, you would be imposing new regulation on a prior agreement when they entered into that. So you would be changing the effect, the effectiveness of the clawback as a tool. You would be changing the rules after they entered into the agreement, or would it just be for all ongoing properties from now on?
Chair Kinney-Guy or Representative Hayden, the way that the bill is constructed with the Dash 1 amendment is it makes it clear that anything that that would be relating the clawback to new provisions that a local government may adopt is prospective. It does not reach back. So the clawback would apply to the existing statute for all those projects currently in play. It would apply to anything added into the future, but it wouldn't claw back for existing projects that had criteria that were established only with the state criteria.
So you still look puzzled. Just say that the clawback is there for projects that have already been approved or future projects, because it's already in the statute, and we're not amending that statute with this bill. What Ms. Baldwin is explaining, and that is the Dash 1, is the effective date of the new criteria that a local government might apply. So those new criteria that Beaverton, for example, might apply would not apply to projects already approved. So any clawback for those projects would only be related to the criteria under the statute now, not under the new criteria that Beaverton might adopt. If Beaverton does adopt new criteria, then the clawback would apply to those.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we've had a motion to adopt the Dash 1. Is there any objection to that? If no, the amendments are adopted. Vice Chair.
Chair Kinney-Guy, I move House Bill 2130 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the House Revenue Committee by prior reference.
Vice Chair Stark moves House Bill 2130 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that it be referred to the House Revenue Committee by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Rev. Bueller?
Yes.
Rev. Evans?
Yes.
Rev. Gallegos?
Yes.
Rev. Hayden?
No.
Rev. Parrish?
Yes.
Rev. Taylor?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Palooza?
Aye.
Chair Kinney-Guy?
Aye. The motion passes. Yay. Pass the bill. Woo. Okay. Are we ready for House Bill 3016?
Not quite yet.
All right. Let's go to the public hearing. Then I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2360. Robin, could you read the bill, please?
2360. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2360 directs the Department of Human Services to notify school districts, teachers, standards, and practices commission, and the Department of Education in cases of alleged child abuse in schools, directs DHS to coordinate with law enforcement on investigation, directs DHS to report outcomes of investigation to said entities.
Okay. Senator Sarah Gelser.
She's on her way.
Great. Bob Jundiff.
Chair Kinney-Guy, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundiff. I'm from Disability Rights Oregon. Thank you very much for hearing this bill. The bill before you is very similar to a bill that we brought forward in the 2013 session, and I just want to give a little background about why we brought that bill forward and why we're back again. In 2012, we received a complaint that some children in a set-aside classroom for children with severe disabilities had been abused. The allegation was that they had been struck many times, pinched, and held in restraints, physical restraints. The parents hadn't known about it, and another employee of the school made a complaint to Department of Human Services. As we know that there's a child abuse reporting statute in Oregon that requires public officials to witness or believe that they have witnessed child abuse as defined in the law to report to Child Protective Services and the Department of Human Services to fulfill that obligation. A teacher had done that and then had never heard anything else about the situation and had then complained to us. We conducted our own investigation at that time and determined a few things. One was that we thought that there was serious concern that abuse had occurred. But we also learned about how the governmental systems respond to these types of complaints, which, frankly, we hadn't known. And what we learned was that this is a type of complaint that the Department of Human Services does not investigate. They do take the complaints, and they make a determination as to whether to investigate or not. And what they told us when we investigated was that their specialty and the area in which they concentrate is on abuse in the home or abuse by parents or family members outside of the home. But when you had a situation in which there was alleged abuse by a school employee, that was an area that they did not conduct their own investigation. What they did do, as we learned, was they filled out a particular form saying that they had screened the situation to determine if it was something they would investigate, made a determination that they would not, and then that particular piece of paper they told us had been sent over to the teacher's standards department. We contacted the teacher's standards department, and they told us that, yeah, they received pieces of paper like this from time to time, but they thought what that paper meant was that Child Protective Services had conducted an investigation and determined there was no abuse. And so they routinely disposed of those pieces of paper. We also learned that in this case that the local police had been contacted, which was appropriate, but they had decided not to investigate because they felt that they didn't have the resources to do so and that they had more important matters to take care of. And so at the end of the day, we had a situation in which there was a concern about abuse that we felt was substantial, but that there had never been an investigation. And the agency that is given the authority to look at abuse by teachers or misconduct by teachers had not done so, for they felt that they had no need to do so, and that part of, in this particular situation, there had been complaints about teachers' aides and a volunteer who, even if the teacher standards and practice department had done an investigation, they would not have investigated those volunteers and those teachers' aides because they're not covered within their purview. That led us to the bill that we brought forward. That bill did not move. We did, in talking with Child Protective Services, we were able to determine that at least we could clear up the problem of the complaint to teacher standards. And we did work with Child Protective Services to do that. And so now we have new administrative rules that direct that those reports should go to Child Protective Services, and at least had the conversation where Child Protective Services and teacher standards understand what their forms mean. So that was progress. However, we're still in a situation in which if there is a complaint of abuse of a child at school and a mandatory reporter, and remember, teachers are mandatory reporters of abuse, makes that report, that there may be nothing that happens and there may be no notification to the school, to the complainant, or anyone else that nothing is going to happen. And that is what brings us to the bill before you, House Bill 2360. And that is our, we think, modest attempt to at least try to make sure that when there is a complaint made about child abuse in the school, that there is some coordination of effort to assure that someone investigates. It doesn't mandate that any particular entity do that investigation, but at least there is some coordination, and that the school is informed as to what happened. And again, as I indicate in our written testimony, this would pertain to all complaints of abuse coming out of the school setting that are mandatory. But our primary concern, our core concern, is for those kids with disabilities who really can't go home and complain to their parents. They can't complain to another teacher. They just don't have the ability to do so. And so we have seen cases in the past in which really parents end up guessing that their child has been subject to something because they stop eating, they stop communicating, they stop acting in the way that they normally do, and the parent then has to start their own investigation to figure out what the heck's going on. So that is why we brought House Bill 2360 for your consideration. I thank you, and of course available to answer any questions.
I don't have a question, but I have a comment.
Yes.
I can't tell you how thrilled I am with this bill. Having been in law enforcement and having seen so many cases fall through the cracks because there wasn't good conversation or communication between law enforcement and DHS, and then you throw in the school district that it was always, they never wanted to call the police because they thought it made them look bad. And so to have these open lines of communication put in place, required, will be huge, absolutely huge. I don't think we can quantify over many, many years how many kids may have not gotten the right service. And it's interesting to me. I know teachers are mandatory reporters, but aren't teachers' aides are not? I thought every school employee was.
Yes, that is true. It says school employees are mandatory reporters.
Okay, thank you. So I'm with you here on this one.
Senator Gelser, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Do you want me to?
Yes.
Am I joking?
All right.
Hello, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state senator from Senate District 8, which is Albany, Corvallis, and surrounding areas. House Bill 2360 is a continuation of a conversation that we've been trying to have over the last couple of years. It's very difficult to get our hands around it, because even though all these people are mandatory reporters, once that report is made, it's really unclear who it is that's responsible for investigating that abuse and imposing a sanction to keep kids safer. As a mandatory reporter myself, particularly after we passed seclusion and restraint legislation, I have on two separate occasions received telephone calls in my office that triggered my mandatory child abuse reporting responsibility. I have called and made the report, and the DHS helpline has said there's nothing that we can do to investigate this because it's not occurring in the family home. In one of these cases, it was a parent that went and found his son locked in a tiny seclusion room with no food or water, nothing to sit on, banging his head against the floor, and he had been locked in that room for quite some time. Nobody could do anything about that. I'm sure that Mr. Jundeff has described to you the investigation that they did. Did you talk about that? Where, again, you have children who are in significant danger, but no matter who reports it, the kids aren't getting help, and those kids remain in danger on a day-to-day basis. I think that House Bill 2360 is a good start in that we can start to keep track of who it is that's inflicting these alleged abuses on kids. The issue is this doesn't pick up everybody that works within a school facility, and it still also does not pick up who it is that's actually investigating the abuse so that the school can do something about it, do better education, substantiate or not substantiate a report, have that become part of a record. I think it would be a fair point to say just because someone makes an allegation doesn't mean it's true, and therefore it shouldn't necessarily go on someone's record. The problem that we have is that there is nobody right now that is set up to investigate these cases. We've had meetings with the Department of Human Services and the Department of Justice together to try to talk about who might that entity be. The DHS, why am I forgetting? The Oregon Office of Abuse
prevention?
Yes, AWAPI. I'm just thinking of the phrase. Together with Department of Justice might be a good place to go after that. But I think this bill is a good place to start. But we have some really vulnerable kids. And just because they're being abused in a place that's not at home doesn't mean that abuse isn't occurring and doesn't mean that they shouldn't be protected. Kids are at school a lot.
Thank you for bringing this to us. Any questions?
I'll give another comment, if I may. You know, we have been very successful with family crimes units, and in some of our agencies throughout the state, police agencies throughout the state, have been able to actually house a DHS worker within a police department. And again, it's building those relationships and that trust. And I just think this is a great first step to make those sorts of programs happen and throughout the entire state where it's needed everywhere.
And, Madam Chair, if I may, I just thought of two other cases where this has come up, where I've been a mandatory reporter that is needed to call and you couldn't get the information to the families. One had to do with an elementary school student, a young child that was pulled into a closet by two other elementary school students and sexually assaulted. The district did their investigations. DHS would be called, but DHS couldn't come in. It also meant that because of school privacy practices, the child who had been the victim, the parents could not be made aware of who the alleged juvenile perpetrator was, which meant that the parents couldn't make the choices that they needed to protect that child. In that particular case, that was a typically developing child that could then disclose that. Same school district, a couple of years later, the school district actually notified the family that they had had to make a report to DHS and that they had to do an investigation because a child in their life skills class, their DD class, had disclosed that he had inappropriately touched another child and said that he was sorry, or she was sorry, that she had done that. The individual who had allegedly been violated was a nonverbal child. So here you have this small classroom, a small community where people are very close together. To this day, that mother still does not know who this alleged perpetrator was. None of the kids went home. So when she invites people over for a birthday party, when they go and do other activities, there is no way for her to ensure that her child is protected from this person that she's had this abusive encounter with. So again, if there's an abuse investigation, if we have a better way to deal with that, we can keep kids safer in a whole variety of ways.
Okay. And we will be having a work session on this in a few days. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2360, open a work session on House Bill 3016. Robin, could you read the bill, please?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3016 restores capital gains tax exemption for sales to entities that include tenants, nonprofits, or housing authorities, modifies time limit for tenants to form or associate with company with competing entities and submit purchase offer, applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2015 and on and before January 1st, 2020, takes effect on 91st day following adjournment sine die. There is a dash 3 amendment increases the fee, increases assessment fee to $10 and imposes reimbursement to counties for processing, increases mobile home park registration fee, cancels unpaid taxes and assessment fees for abandoned mobile home parks, and adds certain utilities as required for habitability rules. It prohibits mandatory consignment sales and clarifies rules for competing sales. So the paperwork is in order, and there is both a minimal fiscal impact and a minimal revenue impact.
Would anyone like John to come back up and answer any questions, or are you set to go? Okay. Let's see. Vice Chair Peluso, could you please?
So this has some amendments, too?
Yep.
Chair Kenny-Guyer, I move to adopt the dash 3 amendments dated 4/13/15.
Vice Chair Peluso moves to adopt the dash 3 amendments dated 4/13/15. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Okay, the amendments are adopted.
Chair Kenny-Guyer, I move House Bill 3016 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Peluso moves House Bill 3016 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk, could you please call the roll?
Rob Bueller?
Yes.
Rob
Evans? Yep.
Rob
Ayer? Yes.
Rob Payton?
Yes.
Rob Perry?
Aye.
Rob Saylor?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stark?
Yes.
Vice Chair Peluso?
Aye.
Chair
Klingar? Aye. The motion passes. Who would like to be the carrier on this? Manufacturer Holmes.
Welcome.
Representative Parrish. Okay. Well, that is it for our bills. We have a lot of bills in the next few days. I think we're down to 29 to pass. So please take a look at them. Let your vice chair know if you have any issues that you would like to flag before we vote on them, and particularly on the tax credits. It's very little time. Let your vice chairs know, but I would also appreciate hearing directly.
Okay, don't get one like that.
Don't. Yeah. Okay.
Give me one tiny second.
Just to close the work session after we assign the carrier.
Yeah, you can close the work session.
Close the work session, thank you, okay. Vice Chair, on House Bill 3016.
And then I think we can adjourn.
We are adjourned.
Hey, already there. Yay!
We are adjourned.
Hey, already there.